Disc 3.
The Tuscan regarded him intently for a long minute, then slowly eased into a sitting position, his wounded leg stretched out in front of him.
Hello,
Anakin said, trying out a smile. The Tuscan raider made no response.
Are you thirsty?
The boy asked. No response.
I don't think he likes us very much, C-3PO observed.
Anakin tried a dozen different approaches at conversation, but the Tuscan raider ignored them all. His gaze shifted only once, to where his blaster rifle lay propped against the rocks behind the boy.
Say something to him in Tuscan, he ordered C-3PO finally.
The droid did. He spoke at length to the Tuscan in his own language, but the man refused to respond. He just kept staring at the boy. Finally, after C-3PO had gone on for some time, the Tuscan glanced at him and barked a single word in response.
Gracious! The droid exclaimed. What did he say?
The boy asked, excited.
Why, he told me to shut up!
That was pretty much the end of any attempt at conversation. The boy and the Tuscan sat facing each other in silence, their faces caught by the glow of the fire, the desert's darkness all around. Anakin found himself wondering what he would do if the Tuscan tried to attack him. It was unlikely, but the man was large and fierce and strong, and if he reached the boy, he could easily overpower him. He could take back his blaster rifle and do with the boy as he chose. But somehow Anakin didn't sense that to be the Tuscan's intent. The Tuscan made no effort to move and gave no indication he had any intention of trying to do so. He just sat there, wrapped in his desert garb, faceless beneath his coverings, locked away with his own thoughts. Finally, he spoke again. The boy looked quickly at C-3PO.
He wants to know what you are going to do with him, Master Anakin, the droid translated.
Anakin looked back at the Tuscan, confused.
Tell him I'm not going to do anything with him, he said. I'm just trying to help him get well.
C-3PO spoke the words in Tuscan. The man listened. He made no response. He did not say anything more. Anakin realized suddenly that the Tuscan was afraid. He could sense it in the way the other spoke, in the way he sat waiting. He was crippled and weaponless. He was at Anakin's mercy. The boy understood the Tuscan's fear, but it surprised him anyway. It seemed out of character. The Sand People were supposed to be fearless. Besides, he wasn't afraid of the Tuscan. Maybe he should have been, but he wasn't. Anakin Skywalker wasn't afraid of anything. Was he? Staring into the opaque lenses of the goggles that hid the Tuscan Raider's eyes, he contemplated the matter. Most times he thought there was nothing that could frighten him. Most times he thought he was brave enough that he would never be afraid. But in that most secret part of himself where he hid the things he would reveal to no one, he knew he was cheating on the truth. He might not ever be afraid for himself, but he was sometimes very afraid for his mother. What if something were to happen to her? What if something awful were to happen to her, something he could do nothing to prevent? He felt a shiver go down his spine. What if he were to lose her? How brave would he be then if the person he was closest to in the whole endless universe was suddenly taken away from him? It would never happen, of course. It couldn't possibly happen. But what if it did? He stared at the Tuscan Raider, and in the deep silence of the night, he felt his confidence tremble like a leaf caught in the wind. He fell asleep, finally, and he dreamed of strange things. The dreams shifted and changed without warning, and took on different storylines and meanings as they did so. He was several things in the course of his dreams. Once he was a Jedi Knight, fighting against things so dark and insubstantial he could not identify them. Once he was a pilot of a star cruiser, taking the ship into hyperspace, spanning whole star systems on his voyage. Once he was a great and feared commander of an army, and he came back to Tatooine with ships and troops at his command to free the planet's slaves. His mother was waiting for him, smiling, arms outstretched. But when he tried to embrace her, she vanished. There were sand people in his dreams, too. They appeared near the end, a handful of them, standing before him with their blaster rifles and long gaffy sticks lifted and held ready. They regarded him in silence, as if wondering what they should do with him. He awoke then, jarred from his sleep by an unmistakable sense of danger. He jerked upright and stared about in confusion and fear. The glow unit had burned down to nothing. In the faint silvery brightening of pre-dawn, he found himself confronted by the dark, faceless shapes of the sand people of his dreams. Anakin swallowed hard. Motionless figures against the horizon's dim glow, the Tusken Raiders encircled him completely. The boy thought to break and run, but realized at once how foolish that would be. He was helpless. All he could do was wait and see what they intended. A guttural muttering rose from their midst, and heads turned to look. Through a gap in the ranks, Anakin could just make out a figure being lifted and carried away. It was the raider he had rescued, speaking to his people. The other raiders hesitated, then slowly backed away. In seconds, they were gone. Sunlight began to crest the dark bulk of the Mospic, and C-3PO was speaking to him in a rush of words that tumbled over one another, the skeletal metal arms jerking this way and that.
"Master Anakin, they've gone! Oh, we're lucky to be alive! Thank goodness they didn't hurt you!"
Anakin climbed to his feet. There were Tusken Raider footprints everywhere. He glanced about quickly. The speeder and the droids obtained from the Jawas sat undisturbed beneath the overhang. The Tusken blaster rifle was gone.
"Master Anakin, what should we do?" C-3PO wailed in dismay.
Anakin looked around at the empty canyon floor, at the high ragged walls of the cliff face, and at the brightening sky where the stars were fading away. He listened to the deep silence and felt impossibly alone and vulnerable.
"We should go home," he whispered,
and moved swiftly to make it happen. 7. Newt Gunray stood in silence at the center of the palace throne room in the Naboo capital city of Theed, and listened patiently as Governor C.O. Bibble protested the Trade Federation presence. Rune Hakko stood at his side. Both wore their Federation robes of office and inscrutable expressions. 2 dozen battle droids held the Naboo occupants of the room at gunpoint. The city had fallen shortly after sunrise. There had been little resistance. The Naboo were a peaceful people. The Trade Federation invasion had come as a surprise, and the droid army was inside the gates of the city before any substantial defense could be mounted. What few weapons there were had been confiscated, and the Naboo removed to detention camps. Battle droids were combing the city even now to put an end to any lingering resistance. Gunray resisted a smile. Apparently, the Queen had believed right up to the end that negotiations would prevail, and the Senate would provide the people of Naboo with protection.
"It is bad enough, Viceroy, that you dare to disrupt transmissions between the Queen and Senator Palpatine while he is attempting to argue our cause before the Republic Senate. Bad enough that you pretend that this blockade is a lawful action. But landing an entire army on our planet and occupying our cities is too outrageous for words."
C.O. Bibble was a tall, balding man with a sharply pointed beard and an even sharper tongue. He held the floor just at the moment, but Gunray was getting tired of listening to him. He glanced at the other captives. Captain Panaka, the Queen's head of security, and 4 of the Queen's personal guards stood to one side, stripped of their weapons and helpless. Panaka was stone-faced and hard-eyed as he watched the Nemoidians. He was a big, powerfully built man with a dark, smooth face and quick eyes. The Nemoidian did not like the way those eyes were fixed on him. The queen sat upon her throne, surrounded by her handmaidens. She was serene and aloof, detached from everything, as if what was taking place had no effect on her, could not touch her in any way. She wore black, her white-painted face in sharp contrast to the black-feathered headdress that wrapped and framed it. A gold chain lay across her regal brow, and the red beauty mark split her lower lip. She was considered beautiful, Gunray had been told, but he had no sense of human beauty, and by Nemoidian standards she was simply colorless and small-featured. What interested him was her youth. She was barely out of girlhood, certainly not a full-grown woman, and yet the people of Naboo had chosen her as their queen. This wasn't one of those monarchies where blood determined right of rule and dynasties prevailed. The Naboo chose the wisest among them as their ruler by popular acclaim, and Queen Amidala governed at the sufferance of her people. Why they would choose someone so young and naive was a mystery to him. From his point of view, it certainly hadn't served them well in this instance. Governor C.O. Bibble's voice echoed through the cavernous chamber, rising to the high vaulted ceiling, bouncing off the smooth, sunlit walls. Theed was an opulent, prosperous city, and the throne room reflected its history of success. "Viceroy, I ask you point blank," C.O. Bibble was concluding his oration. "How do you intend to explain this invasion to the Senate?" The Nemoidian's flat reptilian countenance managed a small flicker of humor. "The Naboo and the Trade Federation will forge a treaty that will legitimize our occupation of Theed. I have been assured that such a treaty, once produced, will be quickly ratified by the Senate." "A treaty?" the governor exclaimed in astonishment. "In the face of this completely unlawful action?" Amidala rose from her throne and stepped forward, surrounded by her cloaked and hooded handmaidens. Her eyes were sharp with anger.
"I will not cooperate."
Newt Gunray exchanged a quick glance with Rune Hakko.
Now, Your Highness," he purred. "Don't be too hasty with your pronouncements. You are not going to like what we have in store for your people. In time, their suffering will persuade you to see our point of view."
He turned away. "Enough talk," he beckoned. "Commander?" Battle droid OOM-9 stepped forward, narrow metal snout lowering slightly in response. "Process them," the viceroy ordered. OOM-9 signaled for one of his sergeants to take over, metallic voice directing that the prisoners be taken to Camp 4. The battle droids herded the queen, her handmaidens, Governor Bibble, Captain Panaka, and the Naboo guards from the room. Newt Gunray's slit reddish-orange eyes followed them out, then shifted back to Hakko and the room. He felt a deep sense of satisfaction take hold. Everything was going exactly as it should. The sergeant and a dozen battle droids moved the prisoners along the polished stone walls of the Theed Palace and outside to where a series of terraced steps led downward through statuary and buttress work to a broad plaza. The plaza was filled with Federation tanks and battle droids and was empty of Naboo citizens. The tanks were squat shovel-nosed vehicles with their main cannon mounted on a turret above and behind the cockpit and smaller blasters set low into either side. They had the look of foraging beetles as they edged about the plaza's perimeter. Beyond, the buildings of Theed stretched away toward the horizon, a vast sprawl of high stone walls, gilded domes, peak towers, and sculpted archways. Sunlight bathed the gleaming edifices, their architecture in counterpoint to the lush greenness of the planet. The rush of waterfalls and bubble of fountains formed a soft, distant backdrop to the strange silence created by the absence of the populace. The prisoners were taken across the plaza, past the Trade Federation machines of war. No one spoke. Even Governor Bibble had gone silent, his gray-bearded head lowered in dark contemplation. They departed the plaza and turned down a broad avenue that led to the outskirts of the city and the newly constructed Trade Federation detention camps. Staps hummed overhead, shadows flitting off the walls of the buildings, metal shells gleaming as they darted away. The droids had just turned their prisoners down a quiet byway when their sergeant, who was leading the procession, brought them to an abrupt halt. Two men stood directly in their way, both wearing loose robes over belted tunics, the taller with his hair worn long, the shorter with his cut to a thin braided pigtail. Their arms hung loosely at their sides, but they did not have the look of men who were unprepared. For a moment each group stared at the other in silence. Then the narrow face of a Gungan peeked out from behind the two robed figures, eyes wide and frightened. Qui-Gon Jinn stepped forward. "Are you Queen Amidala of the Naboo?" he asked the young woman in the feathered headdress. The queen hesitated. "Who are you?" "Ambassadors from the Supreme Chancellor." The Jedi Master inclined his head slightly. "We seek an audience with you, Your Highness." The droid sergeant suddenly seemed to remember where he was and what he was doing. He gestured to his soldiers. "Clear them away!" 4 of the battle droids moved to obey. They were just shifting their weapons into firing position when the Jedi activated their lightsabers and cut them apart. As the shattered droids collapsed, the Jedi moved quickly to dispatch the others. Laser bolts were blocked, weapons were knocked aside, and the remaining droids were reduced to scrap metal. The sergeant turned to flee, but Qui-Gon brought up his hand, holding the droid fast with the power of the Force. In seconds, the sergeant lay in a ruined heap with his command. Quickly, the Naboo soldiers moved to recover the fallen weapons. The Jedi Knights flicked off their lightsabers and motioned everyone out of the open street and into the shelter of an alley between two buildings. Jar Jar Binks followed, muttering in wonder at the cold efficiency with which the Jedi had dispatched their enemies. Qui-Gon faced the Queen. "Your Highness, I am Qui-Gon Jinn, and my companion is Obi-Wan Kenobi. We are Jedi Knights, as well as ambassadors for the Supreme Chancellor." "Your negotiations seem to have failed, Ambassador," C.O. Bibble observed with a snort. "The negotiations never took place." Qui-Gon kept his eyes directed toward the Queen. Her painted face showed nothing. "Your Highness," he continued, "we must make contact with the Republic." "We can't," Captain Panaka volunteered, stepping forward. "They've knocked out all our communications." An alarm was being given from somewhere close, and there was the sound of running. Qui-Gon glanced toward the street where the battle droids lay. "Do you have transports?" The Naboo captain nodded, quick to see what the Jedi intended. "In the main hangar, this way." He led the little group to the end of the alleyway, where they crossed to other passageways and back streets, encountering no one. They moved quickly and silently through the growing sound of alarms and the wicked buzz of steps. To their credit, the Naboo did not resist Qui-Gon's leadership, nor question his appearance. With Panaka and his men newly armed, the Naboo Queen and her companions had a sense of being in control of their own destiny once more, and seemed more than ready to take a chance on their rescuers. It did not take them long to reach their destination. A series of connected buildings dominated one end of a broad causeway, each one domed and cavernous, the central structures warded by arched entrances and low, flat-walled outbuildings. Battle droids were stationed everywhere, weapons held at the ready, but Captain Panaka was able to find an unguarded approach down a narrow corridor between adjoining buildings. At a side door to the main hangar, Panaka brought the group to a halt. After a quick glance over his shoulder for droids, he unlocked and nudged open the hangar door. With Qui-Gon Jinn pressed close, he peered inside. A handful of Naboo ships were grouped at the center of the hangar, sleek, gleaming transports, their noses pointed toward a wide opening in the far wall. Battle droids guarded each, positioned across the entire floor of the hangar to cut off any unseen approach. Panaka pointed to a long, low ship on the far side of the hangar with swept-back wings and powerful head-on 5 engines. "The Queen's personal transport," he whispered to the Jedi Master. Qui-Gon nodded, a J-type 327 Nubian. In the distance, the alarms continued to sound their steady wail.
"That one will do," he said.
Panaka scanned the hangar interior.
"The battle droids. There are too many of them."
The Jedi eased back from the door.
"That won't be a problem."
He faced the Queen.
"Your Highness, under the circumstances, I suggest you come to Coruscant with us."
The young woman shook her head, the feathers on her headdress rustling softly. Her white-painted face was calm and her gaze steady.
"Thank you, Ambassador, but my place is here with my people."
"I don't think so," Qui-Gon responded, locking eyes. "The Trade Federation has other plans. They will kill you if you stay." Seo Bibble pushed to the Queen's side.
"They wouldn't dare."
"They need her to sign a treaty to make this invasion of theirs legal," Captain Panaka pointed out. "They can't afford to kill her."
The Queen looked from face to face, the barest flicker of uncertainty showing in her eyes.
"The situation here is not what it seems," Qui-Gon pressed. "There is something else going on, Your Highness. There is no logic to the Federation's actions. My instincts tell me they will destroy you."
A shadow of real alarm crossed Seo Bibble's face as the Jedi Master finished. His strong features melted slightly.
"Your Highness," he said slowly, "perhaps you should reconsider. Our only hope is for the Senate to take our side in this matter. Senator Palpatine will need your help."
Captain Panaka was having none of it.
"Getting past their blockade is impossible, Your Highness, even if we were to get off the planet. An escape attempt is too dangerous."
"Your Highness, I will stay here and do what I can," Seo Bibble interrupted, shaking his head at Panaka.
"They will have to retain the Council of Governors in order to maintain some semblance of order, but you must leave."
Queen Amidala brought up her hand sharply to silence the debate. Turning from her governor and head of security, and the Jedi as well, she looked suddenly to her handmaidens, who were pressed close about her.
"Either choice presents great risk to all of us," she said softly, looking from face to face.
Qui-Gon watched the exchange, puzzled. What was the Queen seeking? The handmaidens glanced at one another, faces barely visible within the confines of red and gold-hooded robes. All were silent. Finally, one spoke.
"We are brave, Your Highness," Padme said firmly.
Alarms continued to sound.
"If you are to leave, Your Highness, it must be now," Qui-Gon urged.
Queen Amidala straightened and nodded.
"So be it. I will plead our case before the Senate."
She glanced at Seo Bibble.
"Be careful, Governor."
She took the Governor's hand briefly, then beckoned to three of her handmaidens. Those not chosen began to cry softly. Amidala embraced them and whispered words of encouragement. Captain Panaka selected two of the four guards to stay behind with the handmaidens and Seo Bibble. The Jedi Knights moved through the side door and into the hangar, leading the way for Jar Jar and the Naboo. "Stay close," Qui-Gon admonished softly over his shoulder. Captain Panaka moved next to him, dark face intense.
"We need a pilot for the vessel."
He pointed to where a group of Naboo were being held captive in a corner of the hangar by a squad of battle droids. The insignia on their uniforms indicated a mix of guards, mechanics, and pilots.
"There."
"I'll take care of it," Obi-Wan declared, and veered toward the Naboo captives. Qui-Gon and the rest continued on, striding boldly across the hangar floor, moving directly toward the Queen's vessel, ignoring the battle droids who moved to intercept them. Qui-Gon took note of the fact that the boarding ramp to the transport was lowered. More battle droids were closing on them, curious, without yet being alarmed.
"Don't stop for anything," he said to the Queen, and he reached beneath his cloak for the lightsaber.
They were barely 20 meters from the Queen's transport when the nearest of the battle droids challenged them.
"Where are you going?" it asked in its blank metallic voice.
Get out of the way, Qui-Gon ordered. I am an ambassador for the Supreme Chancellor, and I am taking these people to Coruscant. The droid brought up his weapon quickly, blocking the Jedi Master's passage. You are under arrest. It was scrap metal within seconds, dissected by Qui-Gon's lightsaber. More of the battle droids rushed to stop the Jedi, who stood alone against them as his charges boarded the Nubian vessel. Captain Panaka and the Naboo guards formed a protective screen for the Queen and her handmaidens as they hurried up the ramp. Jar Jar Binks clambered after, holding onto his head with his long arms. Laser bolts lanced through the hangar from all directions, and new alarms blared wildly. On the far side of the hangar, Obi-Wan Kenobi launched himself at the battle droids holding the Naboo pilots hostage, cutting into them with ferocious determination. Qui-Gon watched his progress, long hair flying out as he withstood yet another rush from the battle droids attempting to reclaim the Queen's transport, blocking their laser bolts as he fought to hold the boarding ramp. Obi-Wan was running toward him now, a handful of the Naboo in tow. Explosions rose all around them, deadly laser fire burning into metal and flesh. Several of the Naboo went down, but the battle droids were unable to slow the Jedi. Qui-Gon called sharply to Obi-Wan as he went past, telling him to get the ship in the air. More battle droids were appearing at the hangar doors, weapons firing. Qui-Gon backed quickly up the loading ramp and into the transport's dimly lit interior. The ramp rose behind him and closed with a soft whoosh. The head-on five engines were firing even before the Jedi Master reached the main cabin and flung himself into a chair. Laser fire hammered at the sides of the sleek craft, but it was already beginning to move forward. The pilot sat hunched forward over the controls, his weathered face intense, a sheen of sweat beading his forehead, hands steady on the controls. "Hold on," he said. The Nubian shot through the hangar doors, ripping past battle droids and laser fire, lifting away from the city of Theed into the blue sunlit sky. The planet of Naboo was left behind in seconds, the ship rising into the darkness of space, arcing toward a suddenly visible cluster of Trade Federation battleships blocking its way. Qui-Gon left his seat and came forward to stand beside the pilot. "Riccoli," the other announced with a quick glance up at the Jedi. "Thanks for helping out back there." Qui-Gon nodded. "Better save your thanks until we deal with what's up here." The pilot gave him a rakish grin. "Copy that. What do we do about these big boys? Our communications are still jammed." "We're past the point of talking. Just keep the ship on course." Qui-Gon turned to Obi-Wan. "Make sure everyone is settled safely in place." His eyes moved to where Jar Jar Binks was already up and poking about. The younger Jedi moved quickly to take the Gungan in hand, propelling him forcibly through the main cabin door and into the anteway beyond. Ignoring Jar Jar's protests, he glanced about for somewhere to stash the bothersome creature. Catching sight of a low, cramped entry with the words "Astromech Droids" lettered above, he released the retaining latch and shoved the Gungan inside. "Stay here," he directed with a meaningful look, "and keep out of trouble." Jar Jar Binks watched the door close behind him, then glanced around. A line of five R2 astromech droids stood against one wall, short, dome-topped, all-purpose mechanics painted different colors, their lights off, their engines quiet. Five identical units, each stout body positioned between two sturdy restraint arms, they gave no indication of being aware of him. The Gungan ambled along in front of them, waiting to be noticed. Maybe they weren't activated, he thought. Maybe they weren't even alive.
"Heady ho, yous," he tried, hands gesturing. "'Tis a long trip somewheres, hey?"
No response. Jar Jar tapped the closest R2 unit, a bright red droid, on the head. The tap made a hollow sound, and the head popped up a notch from the cylindrical body.
"Whoa!"
Jar Jar said, surprised. He glanced around, wondering why the Jedi had put him down here when everyone else was up there. Nothing much to do down here, he thought disconsolately. Nothing much happening. Curious, he gripped the red droid's head and lifted gently.
"This opens?"
he whispered. He lifted some more. Something caught. He yanked hard.
"This oops?"
The head lifted right out of its seating. Springs and wires popped out in a tangled mess. Jar Jar quickly jammed the red droid's head back into place, easing his three-fingered hands away cautiously.
"Oh,
he murmured, glancing about to make sure no one had seen, hugging himself worriedly. He moved down the line of droids, still looking for something to occupy his time. He didn't want to be in this room, but he didn't think he should try to leave either. The younger Jedi, the one who had stuck him in here, didn't like him much as it was. The Jedi would like him a whole lot less if he caught Jar Jar sneaking out of this room. Explosions sounded close by the transport. Cannon fire. The ship rocked in response to a series of near misses. Jar Jar looked about wildly, suddenly not liking where he was at all. Then the running lights began to flicker, and the transport shook violently. Jar Jar moaned and crouched down in a corner. More explosions sounded, and the craft was buffeted from side to side.
"We doomed," the frightened Gungan muttered. "'Tis bad business, this."
Abruptly, the ship began to spin as if caught in a whirlpool. Jar Jar cried out, fastening his arms about a strut to keep from being thrown against the walls. The lights in the compartment all came on, and the droids were abruptly activated. One by one, they began to whir and beep. Released from their restraints, they rolled out of their racks toward an airlock at one end of the compartment, all but the red R2, who rolled directly into a wall and fell over, more parts tumbling out. The R2 unit, painted blue, paused as it motored by its red counterpart, then charged past Jar Jar, giving out a loud screech that caused the Gungan to jerk away in fright. One after another, the four R2 units entered the airlock lift and were sucked up toward the top of the ship. Left behind in the storage compartment with the droid he had unwittingly sabotaged, Jar Jar Binks moaned in despair. 8. Obi-Wan Kenobi had just re-entered the transport's cockpit when explosions began to buffet the ship. He could see a huge Trade Federation battleship looming ahead through the viewport, cannons firing. The Queen's transport was rocked so violently by the blasts that it was thrown from its trajectory. Rick Oley's gloved hands were locked onto the steering grips, fighting to bring the slender craft back into line. "We should abort, sir," the pilot shouted at Qui-Gon, who was braced at his side, eyes fixed on the battleship. "Our deflector shields can't withstand much more of this." "Stay on course," the Jedi Master ordered calmly. He glanced down at the controls. "Do you have a cloaking device?"
"This is not a warship," Captain Panaka snapped, looking angry and betrayed. "We have no weapons, Ambassador. We're a non-violent people, which is why the Trade Federation was brave enough to attack us in the first place."
A series of explosions jarred the Nubian, and the lights on the control panel flickered weakly. An alarm sounded, shrill and angry. The transport shuddered, its power drive stalling momentarily in a high-pitched whine.
"No weapons," Qui-Gon Jinn breathed.
Obi-Wan was next to him, feeling the weight of the other's gaze as it shifted to find him, steady and unwavering. One hand settled on Rick Oley's shoulder.
"The Trade Federation uses pulsar tracking for its weapons. Spin the ship. It will make it more difficult for them to get a reading on us."
The pilot nodded, flipped a series of levers, and put the Nubian into a slow spin. Ahead, the battleship filled the viewport, then lost focus. The Queen's transport accelerated, racing toward the enemy craft, whipping past towers and gunports, bays and stabilizers, speeding down an alleyway of jagged metal protrusions and cannon fire. A laser bolt hammered into them, causing sparks and smoke to explode from one panel, sending the ship reeling. For a brief moment, they were tumbling out of control. Then Rick Oley pulled back hard on the controls, and the hull of the battleship receded.
"Something's wrong," the pilot announced quietly, fighting the steering, feeling the ship shudder beneath.
"Shields are down!"
They continued to spin, to hug the cavernous shell of the Trade Federation battleship, so close that the larger guns were rendered useless and only the smaller could chance firing at them. But without shields, even a glancing hit could be disastrous.
"Sending out the repair crew," Oli shouted, and flipped a lever.
On the viewscreen, an airlock snapped open, and one by one a series of astromech droids popped out of the hatch and onto the transport's hull. The transport straightened and leveled out, and the spinning stopped. The droids motored swiftly across the hull, seeking out the damage as Rick Oli hugged the battleship's shadow in an effort to protect them. But now there was a new threat. Unable to bring the weapons of their warship to bear in an effective manner, the Trade Federation Command dispatched a squad of starfighters. Small, sleek robot attack ships, they consisted of twin compartments attached to a rounded, swept-back head. As they roared out of the battleship bays, their compartments opened into long slits that exposed their laser guns. Down the length of the mothership they tore, seeking out the Queen's transport. Fast and maneuverable, they had no trouble working close to the battleship's hull. In seconds, they were on top of the transport, weapons firing. Rick Oli struggled to find cover and gain speed. Two of the R2 units were blown away, one on a direct hit, the second when its hold on the transport hull was shattered. On the viewscreen, the blue R2 unit could be seen working furiously to connect a series of wires exposed by a damaged hull plate. Laser fire lanced all around it, but it continued its effort without stopping. The fourth droid, working close by, disappeared in a cloud of shattered metal and brilliant fire. Now only the blue unit remained, still busy amid the onslaught of Trade Federation starfighters. Something changed on the cockpit display, and Rick Oli gave a shout of approval. "The shields are up! That little droid did it!" He jammed the thrusters all the way forward, and the transport rocketed away from both the battleship and the starfighters, leaving the Trade Federation blockade and the planet of Naboo behind. The lone R2 unit turned and motored back into the airlock and disappeared from view. When they were well away from any Trade Federation presence, Rick Oli made a thorough check of the controls, assessing their damage, trying to determine what was needed. Obi-Wan sat next to him in the co-pilot seat, lending help. Qui-Gon and Captain Panaka stood behind them, awaiting their report. The Queen and the rest of the Naboo had been secured in other chambers. Rick Oli shook his head doubtfully. "We can't go far. The hyperdrive is leaking." Qui-Gon Jinn nodded. "We'll have to land somewhere to make repairs to the ship. What's out there?" Rick Oli punched in a star chart, and they hunched over the monitor, studying it. "Here, Master," Obi-Wan said, his sharp eyes picking out the only choice that made any sense. "Tatooine. It's small, poor, and out of the way. It attracts little attention. The Trade Federation has no presence there."
"How can you be sure?" Captain Panaka asked quickly.
Qui-Gon glanced at him.
"It's controlled by the Hutts."
Panaka started in alarm.
"The Hutts?"
"It's risky," Obi-Wan agreed, "but there's no reasonable alternative."
Captain Panaka was not convinced.
"You can't take Her Royal Highness there. The Hutts are gangsters and slavers. If they discovered who she was..."
"It would be no different than if we landed on a planet in a system controlled by the Trade Federation," Qui-Gon interrupted. "Except the Hutts aren't looking for the Queen, which gives us an advantage." The Queen's head of security started to say something more, then thought better of it. He took a deep breath instead, frustration etched on his smooth, dark face, and turned away. Qui-Gon Jinn tapped Rick Oli on the shoulder. "Set course for Tatooine." In a remote conference room on the Trade Federation's flagship, Newt Gunray and Roon Hakko sat side by side at a long table, staring nervously at a hologram of Darth Sidious positioned at the table's head. The hologram shimmered with the movements of the Sith Lord's dark cloak, a patchwork of small nuances that the Nemoidians found themselves unable to read. The Sith Lord had not been summoned. The Nemoidians would have been happy if he had chosen not to communicate with them at all this day. But in keeping with the way he always seemed to sense when things were not going right, he had appeared on his own. Demanding a report on the progress of the invasion, he had settled back to listen to Newt Gunray's narrative, and had said nothing since. "We control all the cities in the northern and western part of the Nabu territory," the viceroy was relating, "and we are searching for any other settlements where resistance..."
"Yes, yes," Darth Sidious interrupted suddenly, his soft voice vaguely impatient. "You've done well. Now then, destroy all their high-ranking officials. Do so quietly, but be thorough."
He paused.
"What of Queen Amidala? Has she signed the treaty?"
Newt Gunray took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
"She has disappeared, my lord. There was an escape."
"An escape?"
The Sith Lord spoke the words in a low hiss.
"One Naboo cruiser got past the blockade."
"How did she escape, Viceroy?"
Newt Gunray looked at Roon Hakko for help, but his counterpart was paralyzed with fear.
"The Jedi, my lord. They found their way to her, overpowered her guards."
Darth Sidious stirred within his robes like a big cat, shadows glimmering within the confines of his concealing hood.
"Viceroy, find her. I want that treaty signed."
"My lord, we have been unable to locate the ship she escaped on," the Nemoidian admitted, wishing he could sink into the floor right then and there.
"Viceroy!"
"Once it got by us, we tried to give pursuit, but it managed to elude us. Now it's out of our range."
A wave of one robed arm cut him short.
"Not for a Sith, it isn't," the other whispered.
Something shimmered in the background of the hologram, and a figure emerged from the darkness behind Darth Sidious. Newt Gunray froze. It was a second Sith Lord. But whereas Darth Sidious was a vague and shadowy presence, this new Sith was truly terrifying to look upon. His face was a mask of jagged red and black patterns, the design etched into his skin, and his skull was hairless and studded with a crown of short, hooked horns. Gleaming yellow eyes fixed on the Nemoidians, breaking past their defenses, stripping them bare and dismissing them as insignificant and foolish.
"Viceroy," Darth Sidious spoke softly in the sudden silence. "This is my apprentice, Lord Maul. He will find your lost ship."
Newt Gunray inclined his head slightly in acknowledgement, averting his eyes from the frightening presence.
"Yes, my lord."
The hologram shimmered and disappeared, leaving the conference room empty of sound. The Nemoidians sat without moving, without even looking at each other, reptilian eyes fixed on the space the hologram had occupied.
"This is getting out of hand,"
Newt Gunray ventured finally, his voice high and tight, thinking that their plans for sabotaging the trade routes tax did not contemplate risking their lives in the process. Roon Hakko managed a quick nod.
"We should not have made this bargain. What will happen when the Jedi become aware that we are doing business with these Sith Lords?"
Newt Gunray, his hands clasped tightly before him, did not care to venture an answer. Aboard the Queen's transport, the Jedi stood with Captain Panaka and the remaining R2 unit as the captain gave his report to the Queen on the events surrounding their escape through the Trade Federation blockade. Amidala sat, surrounded by her three handmaidens, white face framed by the black headdress, dark eyes steady, listening as the captain concluded.
"We are lucky to have this one in our service, Your Highness."
Panaka glanced down at the blue-domed astromech droid. "It is an extremely well-put-together little droid. Without a doubt, it saved the ship back there, not to mention our lives." Amidala nodded, eyes shifting to the droid.
"It is to be commended. What is its number?"
The little blue droid, lights blinking on and off as it processed the conversation, gave a series of small beeps and tweets. Captain Panaka reached down and scraped a large smudge off the droid's metal shell, then straightened. R2-D2, Your Highness. Queen Amidala leaned forward, and a slender white hand came out to touch the droid's domed casing.
Thank you, R2-D2. You have proven both loyal and brave.
She glanced over her shoulder.
Padme.
One of her handmaidens came forward. Qui-Gon Jinn, listening to the exchange with half an ear as he considered the problems that lay ahead on Tatooine, noticed it was the young woman who had supported the Queen's decision to escape from Naboo. He frowned. Except, it hadn't been exactly like that.
See to the cleaning up of this little droid.
The Queen was speaking to the girl.
R2-D2 deserves our gratitude.
She turned back to Panaka.
Please continue with your report, Captain.
Panaka glanced uncomfortably at the Jedi Knights.
Your Highness, we are heading for a remote planet called Tatooine.
He paused, unwilling to speak further on the matter.
It is a system far beyond the reach of the Trade Federation.
Qui-Gon stepped into the gap smoothly. Once there, we will be able to make needed repairs to the ship, then to travel on to Coruscant and complete our journey.
Your Highness, Captain Panaka said quickly, regaining his thoughts on the matter. Tatooine is very dangerous. It's controlled by the Hutts. The Hutts are gangsters and slavers. I do not agree with the Jedi on their decision to land there.
The Queen looked at Qui-Gon. The Jedi did not waver.
You must trust my judgment, Your Highness.
Must I?
Amidala asked quietly. She shifted her gaze to her handmaidens, ending with Padme. The girl had not moved from the Queen's side, but seemed to remember suddenly she had been given a task to complete. She nodded briefly to the Queen and moved to take R2-D2 in hand. Amidala looked back at Qui-Gon Jinn.
We are in your hands, she advised,
and the matter was settled.
Jar Jar Binks had been left in the droid storage hold until after the lone R2 unit returned through the airlock and the Naboo came to retrieve it. They didn't seem to have any orders regarding the Gungan, so they simply left him to his own devices. At first Jar Jar was reluctant to venture out, still thinking of the younger Jedi's admonishment to stay put and out of trouble. He'd managed one out of two, and he wasn't sure he wanted to tempt fate. But in the end, his curiosity and restlessness got the better of him. The transport had stopped spinning, the Trade Federation attack had ceased, and the warning alarms had been silenced. Everything was peaceful, and the Gungan saw no reason why he should have to stay shut away in this tiny room for one more minute. So he cracked the door, stuck his billed face out for a look around, eye stalks swiveling guardedly, saw no one, and made his decision. He left the storage room and wandered along the ship's corridors, choosing a path that took him away from the cockpit, where the Jedi were likely to be found. He waited for someone to tell him to go back to where he had come from, but no one did. So he began to poke into things, careful what he touched, but unable to help himself sufficiently to forego all investigation. He was following a narrow corridor that led up from the lower levels of the transport to the main cabin, when he poked his head through an airlock to find one of the Queen's handmaidens hard at work with an old cloth cleaning the R2 astromech droid.
"Hey-de-ho!" he called out.
The handmaiden and the R2 unit both started, the girl with a small cry and the droid with a loud beep. Jar Jar jumped in turn, then slowly eased himself through the opening, embarrassed that he had frightened them so badly.
"Me sorry,"
he apologized.
"Me not mean to scare yous, okiday?"
The girl smiled.
"That's all right. Come over here."
Jar Jar came forward a few steps, studying the condition of the droid.
"Me find oil can back there. Yous need it?"
The girl nodded.
"It would help. This little guy is quite a mess."
Jar Jar scrambled back through the opening, groped about a bit, found the oil can he had remembered, and brought it to the girl.
"This helps?"
"Thank you," she said, accepting the can.
She flipped up the cap and poured some of the oil onto the cloth, then began rubbing the R2 unit's dome.
"Me Jar Jar Binks,"
Jar Jar said after a few moments, taking a chance on trying to continue the conversation. He liked this Naboo girl.
"I'm Padme," the girl answered. "I attend Her Highness, Queen Amidala. This is R2-D2.
She rubbed a black smudge from the droid's strut.
"You're a Gungan, aren't you?"
Jar Jar nodded, long ears flapping against his neck.
"How did you end up here with us?"
Jar Jar thought about it a minute.
"Me not know exactly. The day start orchid day with the sun up. Me munchin' clams. Then boom! Mechaniques every which way. They flyin', they scootin'. Me get very scared. Then Jedi runnin' and me grab Qui-Gon. Then mechaniques rollin' over. Then go down under the lake to Otagunga to the Bos Nass."
He stopped, not knowing where else to go. Padme was nodding encouragingly. R2-D2 beeped.
"'Tis about it. Before me know what, pow, me here."
He sat back on his haunches and shrugged.
"Get very, very scared."
He looked from the girl to the droid. Padme smiled some more. R2-D2 beeped again. Jar Jar felt pretty good. In the cockpit, Rick Oley was directing the transport toward a large yellowish planet that was steadily filling up the viewport as they approached its surface. The Jedi and Captain Panaka stood behind him, peering over his shoulder at the ground maps he had punched up on the monitors. "Tatooine," Obi-Wan Kenobi confirmed, speaking to no one in particular. Rick Oley pointed to one of the maps on the scopes.
"There's a settlement that should have what we need. A spaceport, it looks like. Mos Espa."
He glanced up at the Jedi.
"Land near the city's outskirts," Qui-Gon Jinn ordered. "We don't want to attract attention."
The pilot nodded and began to guide the transport in. It took only moments to direct it down through the planet's atmosphere to a patch of desert just inside of the city. The Nubian landed in a swirl of dust, settling comfortably in place atop its landing struts. In the distance, Mos Espa glimmered faintly through the shimmer of the midday heat. Qui-Gon sent his protégé to uncouple the hyperdrive, and Captain Panaka to advise the Queen of their landing. He was settled on going into the spaceport alone, as he left the cockpit to find other clothing, and came upon Jar Jar Binks, the Queen's handmaiden Padme, and the little R2 unit. He slowed, considering the possibility that going into the city alone would make him more noticeable.
"Jar Jar," he said finally, "get ready. You're going with me. The droid as well."
He continued on without looking back. The Gungan stared after him in disbelief, then in horror. By the time he regained his wits, the Jedi was out of view. Wailing in dismay, he chased after him and came upon Obi-Wan in the main cabin hoisting the hyperdrive out of the bowels of the ship.
"Obi-Wan, sire!"
he gasped, throwing himself to his knees in front of the younger Jedi.
"Please, me no co it, Qui-Gon!"
Obi-Wan was inclined to agree, but knew better than to say so.
"Sorry, but Qui-Gon is right. This is a multinational spaceport, a trading center. You'll make him appear less obvious by going along."
His brow furrowed as he turned back to the hyperdrive.
"I hope," he muttered to himself.
Jar Jar climbed to his feet and trudged disconsolately toward R2-D2, his mouth set in a grimace of forbearance. The astromech droid beeped in sympathy, then made a series of encouraging clicks. Qui-Gon reappeared, dressed now as a farmer in tunic, leggings, and a poncho. He walked past them to where Obi-Wan was studying the hyperdrive. "What have you found?" Obi-Wan's young face clouded.
"The generator is shot. We'll need a new one."
"I thought as much."
The Jedi Master knelt next to his protégé.
"Well, we can't risk a communication with Coruscant this far out on the edge of the galaxy. It might be intercepted and our position revealed. We'll have to get by on our own."
He lowered his voice to a near whisper.
"Don't let anyone send a transmission while I'm gone. Be wary, Obi-Wan.
I sense a disturbance in the Force. Obi-Wan's eyes lifted to find his.
I feel it also, Master. I will be careful.
Qui-Gon rose, gathered up Jar Jar and the R2 unit, and headed down the loading ramp to the planet's floor. An empty carpet of sand stretched away in all directions, broken only by massive rock formations and the distant skyline of Mos Espa. The suns that gave the planet life beat down with such ferocity that it seemed as if they were determined to steal that life back again. Heat rose off the sand in a shimmering wave, and the air was so dry it sucked the moisture from their throat and nose passages. Jar Jar glanced skyward, eyestalks craning, billed amphibious face wrinkling in dismay.
"This sun gonna do murder to the skin of this Gungan," he muttered.
At a signal from Qui-Gon, they began to walk, or, in the case of the R2 unit, to roll. A strange caravan of animals and riders, carts and sleds, appeared against the distant skyline like a shadowy mirage, all misshapen and threatening to evaporate in the blink of an eye. Jar Jar muttered some more, but no one was paying attention. They had not gotten far when a shout brought them around. Two figures were running toward them from the transport. As they neared, Qui-Gon was able to make out Captain Panaka and a girl dressed in rough peasant's garb. He stopped and waited until they caught up, a frown creasing his leonine features. Panaka was sweating.
"Her Highness commands you to take her handmaiden with you. She wishes for Padme to give her own report of what you might..."
"No more commands from Her Highness today, Captain," Qui-Gon interrupted quickly, shaking his head in refusal. "Mos Espa is not going to be a pleasant place for—"
"The Queen wishes it," Panaka interrupted him right back, his face angry and set. "She is emphatic. She wishes to know more about this planet."
The girl took a step forward. Her dark eyes found Qui-Gon's.
"I've been trained in self-defense. I speak a number of languages. I am not afraid. I can take care of myself."
Captain Panaka sighed, looking over his shoulder toward the ship.
"Don't make me go back and tell her you refuse."
Qui-Gon hesitated, prepared to do exactly that. Then he looked at Padme again, saw strength in her eyes, and changed his mind. She might be useful. Traveling with a girl, they might suggest a family in transit and present a less aggressive look. He nodded.
"I don't have time to argue the matter, Captain. I still think this is a bad idea, but she may come."
He gave Padme a look of warning.
"Stay close to me."
He started away again, the others trailing. Captain Panaka stood watching with undisguised relief as the strange little procession of Jedi Master, Handmaiden, Gungan, and Astromech Droid moved off into the sweltering landscape toward Mos Espa. 9. It was not yet mid-afternoon by the time the members of the little company under Qui-Gon Jinn's command reached Mos Espa and made their way toward the spaceport's center. Mos Espa was large and sprawling and had the look of a gnarled serpent hunkered down in the sand to escape the heat. The buildings were domed and thick-walled and curved to protect against the sun, and the stalls and shops were fronted by awnings and verandas that provided a measure of shade to their vendors. Streets were broad and packed with beings of every shape and size, most from off-planet. Some rode the desert-seasoned Eopes. Domesticated banthas, massive and horned, and lumbering dewbacks hauled carts, sleds, and wagons that ran on wheels and mechanical tracks by turn, a mishmash of commerce trafficking between Tatooine's smaller ports and the planets of star systems beyond. Qui-Gon kept a close watch for trouble. There were Rodians and Dugs and others whose purpose was always suspect. Most of those they passed paid them no notice. One or two turned to glance at Jar Jar, but dismissed the Gungan almost out of hand once they got a good look at him. As a group, they blended in nicely. There were so many combinations of creatures of every species that the appearance of one more meant almost nothing. Tatooine is home to Jabba the Hutt, who controls the bulk of the trafficking in illegal goods, piracy, and slavery that generates most of the planet's wealth. Qui-Gon was explaining to Padme. He had been on Tatooine before, though it had been some years ago. Jabba controls the spaceports and settlements, all of the populated areas. The desert belongs to the Jawas, who scavenge whatever they can find to sell or trade, and to the Tuskens, who live a nomadic life and feel free to steal from everyone. The Jedi kept his voice low and conversational. The girl walked silently at his elbow, her sharp eyes taking in everything. Speeders nosed by them, and droids of every size toiled in the service of desert-garbed aliens. There are a number of farms as well, outlying operations that take advantage of the climate. Moisture farms, for the most part, operated by off-worlders, not a part of the indigenous tribes and scavengers, not connected directly to the huts. His eyes swept the street ahead. This is a rough and dangerous place. Most avoid it. Its few spaceports have become havens for those who do not wish to be found. Padme glanced up at him. "Like us," she said. A pair of domesticated banthas rumbled down the broad avenue, hairy bulks clearing a path for a sled train of quarry blocks and metal struts, horned heads nodding sleepily, padded feet stirring sand and dust in thick clouds with each lumbering step. Their driver dozed atop the foremost sled in the train, small and insignificant in their shadow. Jar Jar Binks stayed as close as he could manage to the Jedi and the girl, his eyes darting left and right, head swiveling as if it might twist right off his shoulders. Nothing he saw was familiar or welcome. Hard looks followed after him. Sharp eyes measured him for things he would just as soon not think about. Stares were at best challenging and at worst unfriendly. He did not like this place. He wished he were almost anywhere else.
"'Tis very bad, this."
He swallowed against a dryness in his throat that was caused by more than the heat.
"Nothing good about this place."
He took a careless step and found himself ankle-deep in a foul-smelling ooze.
"Oh, oh, 'tis icky."
R2-D2 rolled cheerfully along at his side, beeping and chirping in a futile effort at reassuring the Gungan that all was well. They traveled the main street of the spaceport to its far end and turned down a side street that led to a small plaza ringed with salvage dealers and junk shops. Qui-Gon glanced at the mounds of engine parts, control panels, and communication chips recovered from starships and speeders. "We'll try one of these smaller dealers first," he advised, nodding toward one in which a vast pile of old transports and parts was heaped within an attached compound. They walked through the shop's low entry and were greeted by a pudgy blue creature who flew into their faces like a crazed probe, tiny wings buzzing so fast they could barely be seen.
"Hey, Chubadanago!"
it snapped in a frizzy, guttural voice, demanding to know their business. A Toydarian, Qui-Gon thought. He knew enough to recognize one, but not much else. "I need parts for a J-Type 327 Nubian," he advised the other. The Toydarian fairly beamed with delight, his reticular snout curling over his toothy mouth and making odd smacking noises.
"Ah, yes, a Nubian! We have lots of that!"
The sharp, bulbous eyes flicked from one face to the other, ending with the Gungan.
"What's this?"
Jar Jar shrank behind Qui-Gon fearfully. "Never mind that." The Jedi brushed the Toydarian's question aside. "Can you help us or not?"
"Can you pay me or not? That's the question."
The skinny blue arms crossed defiantly over the rounded torso as the Toydarian regarded them with disdain.
"What kind of junk you after, farmer?"
"My droid has a readout of what I need," Qui-Gon advised the other with a glance down at the R2 unit. Still hanging midair in front of Qui-Gon's nose, the Toydarian glanced over one shoulder.
"Pidokol, Nabadiunko!"
A small, disheveled boy raced in from the salvage yard, coming to an uncertain stop in front of them. His clothes were ragged and thick with grime, and he had the look of someone about to be given a beating. He flinched as the Toydarian wheeled back and lifted a hand in admonishment.
"What a took you so long?"
"Meltas chopas ki,"
the boy responded quickly, blue eyes taking in the newcomers with a quick glance.
"I was cleaning out the bin like you..."
"Chut, chut!"
The Toydarian threw up his hands angrily.
Never mind it, Abin. Watch the store. I've got some selling to do.
He flitted back around to face his customers.
So, let me take you out back. You'll soon find what you need.
He darted toward the salvage yard, beckoning Qui-Gon eagerly. The Jedi followed, with R2-D2 trundling after. Jar Jar moved to a shelf and picked up an odd-looking bit of metal, intrigued by its shape, wondering what it was. Don't touch anything, Qui-Gon called over his shoulder, his tone of voice sharp. Jar Jar put the item down and made a face at Qui-Gon's departing back, sticking out his long tongue in defiance. When the Jedi was out of sight, he picked up the part again.
This book is continued on Disc 4.